Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison and to our speaker, Reverend Jane Espenson. There's a lot of things I could say to introduce you, but many of you have already heard the introduction this morning. Someone who has a lot to say about the need for humanist groups to have humanist language. He was also a former employee of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which turned out to be too dogmatic on the other side. I guess we'll just open it up to whatever you want to say, Jane, and for questions and answers. I know there are a lot of things we didn't get to say this morning. Maybe say something about that, or should we just open it up for questions?
Yeah, just open it up for questions, because I always have something to say, but I need kind of like a starting point, so.
Do you want to say anything about your work in Sweden?
Yes, I've been living in Sweden for the last almost 3 years, and I was teaching comparative literature in the high schools there, in this little town I lived in, an island in the Baltic Sea in northern Sweden. And then I was also asked to teach Swedish to the latest wave of immigrants who were coming to Sweden. And they were from Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia. And the reason that I was chosen to teach them Swedish was because I was no little young person. So I could show that it was possible for an older person, not elderly yet, but older, on my way, to learn a foreign language. And then also I would have an understanding of how to come at thinking about Swedish and how to learn it, because you don't know your own language sometimes, but you know a foreign language, and you know what the difficulties are and the challenges are, and you can also make a lot of fun, you know, and you can laugh about potatoes being the constant thing that you're eating all of the time, when you come from a culture where rice is really the thing, and where things are very white and very calm, when you're used to a culture that has things that are very burning hot in your mouth, and you come to a culture where people are very polite and quiet and gentle and respectful, when you come from a culture where everybody's in groups and they're hugging and they're kissing and they're dancing and they're loud. So, I mean, there were a lot of interesting things, but that was also... Sweden was an amazing, amazing respite for me, an amazing haven in the world. Coming from America under Bush, it was great to be there. And the Swedes couldn't imagine why Americans had voted for Bush once, not less twice. And I tried to explain what had really happened. And it was amazing to live in a very intelligent, secular country. Even though the state church is... Lutheran. People only go to the church on Christmas Eve and on Easter, and that's it. Otherwise, the church is used by the community for concerts and all sorts of things. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place, but it's a secular country. So it's very wise, and it's very humanistic, because it has this humanitarian aspect. It's a social democracy. It's a welfare state. Everybody is provided for. I was asked to speak at Camp Unistar, which is a Unitarian camp in northern Minnesota, to be their ministerial leader for the summer. And so in August, a week in August, the second week in August, I'm going to be speaking, and it's called Across the Great Divide, my talk, and I'm going to be speaking for the week on this, comparing the 7 purposes and principles of Unitarian Universalism with the country of Sweden. Because we see these 7 purposes and principles as ideals toward which to strive, and Sweden has actually implemented these things. They lead their life this way. And what I'm hoping at the end of those 7 days is with who's ever there, we can come up with some very concrete, tangible ways that we can implement these 7 purposes and principles in our own communities, and to try to make some changes in the United States and just start small and see what happens. But it's all very humanistic at its core, because that's what it is. Yeah.
I believe I read that Sweden was the only country that would accept Abu Ghraib people.
I don't know that. Right? I don't know that.
But I wondered if that was... Am I wrong?
It was a small island nation in the Pacific that is going to accept $100 million to take some prisoners.
Wow. Hello? Okay. Something wrong about that?
Who is this they're taking?
Abu Ghraib. No,
Guantanamo.
Gitmo prisoners from Cuba.
Not Abu Ghraib?
Well, some of them I think were probably in Guantanamo, right? After Abu Ghraib was closed, they probably got shipped out.
That could be, yeah.
I don't think anybody agreed to take that group of Chinese.
The Uyghurs?
That's that Palau thing, I think. Or no, Bermuda.
The Uyghurs?
Bermuda, there were pictures of them swimming.
The Uyghurs.
But it's spelled with an O.
I guess I have a question for a totally different subject, sorry. The impression that I got when I heard you speak this morning is that you came to feel strongly about humanism more as an adult. But I was curious, what kind of educational process did you go through? And what would you recommend for other adults who want to be more educated on humanism? What resources are out there?
Yes, I had never heard the word humanism since I lived in a Christian culture and I'd only heard about God and Jesus. I didn't know. And like I said, I was open to all of that and it didn't ever happen. But just the humanitarian aspect. So the word humanitarian was part of my growing up. I always heard humanitarian, you have to be a humanitarian. Mm-hmm. So the first time I ever heard about humanists was actually when I met Corin Arisian, who is one of the humanist UU leaders in the nation, he's retired now. And he spoke at First Universalist Church, actually, where I was working, and I was the presenter that day. And I met him, and he talked about humanism. And everything that he said was everything that I believed and understood already and was. And so I went and spoke to him about that. And then I said I was in seminary and going to this Christian seminary. And so he said, "Oh dear. If you need a mentor during this time, I would be honored to be your mentor." And I said, "Oh, great." I had no idea what I was in for. But I was like, yay, how exciting to have Corin Arisian be my mentor. So then I was very involved with him and then First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis, which is a very large Unitarian congregation, which is humanist. It's huge, and it's wonderful and amazing. And what I learned from Corin, you know, I heard all these negative things about humanists, and I didn't really get that, because what Corin was saying was that, you know, you think with your heart, and you feel with your head. So there isn't this head, intellectual, heart, and it's all separate, but you're doing all those things at the same time. Your heart is what's thinking, and your head is what is feeling, and that's what guides you, and that's the ethical and moral way to be guided. And then I was introduced to, of course, the writings of John Dietrich and all of these amazing people from the past who are these strong humanists. And then I was invited to be a member of the Humanist Institute in New York City, which meets the Ethical Culture Society, which is, again, the Ethical Culture Society. And what a great title. Oh, my gosh. I never heard of it. And I thought, what beautiful language. Ethical culture. That is toward what we should strive. And so I went there, and I would just say that if you do something like that, if you want to be a humanist leader, that's what it's for. But there are many, many good writings and readings, and there's just literature out there about humanism, and just written from a common sense standpoint of just being good, thoughtful people trying to make the world a better place to live in. And
So it must have been very disappointing to learn that the flooding of New Orleans was due to the homosexual, secular humanists and People for American Rights.
I was shocked. I would not have believed it.
What I want to know is, why did God spare Bourbon Street?
We don't know all. Life is a mystery.
It's a little higher elevation.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences with congregations that you've been a minister to?
Mm-hmm. I've been mostly a minister, or I would say always a minister, to small, originally humanist, lay-led congregations. And I started, I would be invited to speak when I was a student, I would be invited to speak at UU congregations, And then I would always be called to be their first minister that they would want, because they were thinking, should we have a minister, should we not? And then they were small, and they were lay-led, and they were human ministers and sorcerers, that, all that. We want a minister. No, we don't. Yes, we do. No, we don't. We want to grow. No, we don't. We like how we're small. No, we want to grow. So there's all of that.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
We know about that here. Yeah.
And so I would be asked to be the minister, the consulting minister for these small congregations. And I felt very honored to be the first one that they would actually want to be, come and talk to us and help us decide what we want to do. And what was interesting is when they did have a minister, they started to grow, that people did want to come in, that there really was something about that. Somehow. And but what I also thought was really interesting is here's this lay-led congregations that had functioned very well for a very long time and very effectively. And then when I'm the minister coming in, all of a sudden everything is just like given to Jane. And the committees didn't know how to be committees anymore, and people couldn't do anything anymore, and all of a sudden they lost all of their capacity. Because now there is a minister in place. And I was like, what? What is that all about? And so that was a little bit of a learning, like, no. Here's my role. This is what I do. And this is what you need to be doing. And still, it's a congregation. The congregation of polity, it's the congregation that decides. It's not top down. The minister's not raised up and top down. Yeah.
Oh. Did any of these small congregations that you've worked with have what I think we're looking at as a shared ministry, where it's partially lay-led and partially ministry?
Well, absolutely. I was only part-time, so they met
that's,
four
but
times.
They were looking for a full-time minister?
Not at that point.
Oh, no. Okay.
They were scared to even have a minister come in at all, so they were just like, let's just see how this is going to be. So I was just part-time. And then they wanted to, but they wanted that mix. They wanted to have the lay-led, the voices from the community, the voices from the congregation, and but then also have this ministerial presence and maybe have a different kind of service that a minister could bring. And that was always a question, what is that? You know, what does the minister bring? And what I was able to bring were my experience as seminary, my experience as a hospital chaplain, I mean, just life experiences, and then my thoughts about that and my experiences with that, and then making presenting that just in a broader context that would a universal message. Instead of the smaller congregation, instead of the lay-led, which might be a particular topic or a particular thing. So I was able to bring that.
Where did those congregations go after your time with them was finished?
Some of them... Well, I think they all ended up having a minister. Some of them are still some are still part-time minister and lay-led. They stayed small. The River Falls congregation has a full-time minister, and they have now grown to, and they have a big church. I mean, 130 people or something like that, and they're really growing. And the Menominee congregation has just... a guy who is going through seminary or something like that. So they're doing that, sort of the consulting minister. So they have sort of stopped growing. But that might be their choice. I don't really know. I'm not involved. I don't really know. When the Menominee congregation, when I first started meeting with them as their speaker, they met in a Quaker meeting house. And so they would share that space. And they would actually share the time of day, you know, with the Quakers. So there was a lot of this in and out. Well, one day I was driving, and I wasn't from Menominee, I lived in River Falls. So one day I was just driving around town, and I noticed this beautiful building, stone building, and it said the Mabel Tainter. And so I parked, and I went in, and the doors were open. I was all very excited, and I walk in this beautiful domed foyer and the marble floor, and smack dab in front of me was this huge plaque, I mean, big, like this. And the first line of the plaque says, "This is the permanent home of the Unitarian Society of Menominee." I'm like, what? And it was the Tainter family built the building. They were Unitarians. This was in the 1800s. The Unitarian Society was big and strong and viable and important in Menominee. It was huge, huge, huge. And I go back to the little Quaker meeting house and go, did you know that right up the street there is that really big building? Have you ever seen that? Oh, yeah, the Mabel Tainter. I said, have you ever been inside? Oh, yeah, many times. The Historical Society has it. And I said, well, did you happen to notice this plaque right in the foyer? Oh, I don't know. And I said, it says this is the permanent home of the Unitarian Society. Oh, yeah, I do kind of remember that. No, no. So I said, does that really mean that? We don't know. And so for 70 years, they didn't know. So I went and I met with the Historical Society and I said, does that plaque actually mean what I think it means? That this really is the permanent home? Oh, yeah. I said, so what would it take for us to go and come here? And we'll just come here. I said, that's it? Yes. And I said, would I have, is there, and you could use the pastor's study. And it's all gilded and gold and gorgeous and it's amazing. And so we did a little field trip out of the Quaker home, up the steps into this beautiful thing, and I did the presentation. Permanent home means permanent home. We get to move in here if we'd like to do that. And so we're like, really? So that's what happened. And that's where I was ordained. I was called to be their ordained, and called minister, and it was in that amazing place. And they are still there.
Well, maybe we should go around in Madison.
There might be some.
There is a big building.
Now, no fair planting the plaque.
Oh, look! Who would have known? It's, I thought it was the Capitol, but look at
it. Little white lies.
I have another question for you. It's similar to my adult education theme, I guess I'm on. So you mentioned that you had not heard really of humanism or even kind of the Unitarian fellowships. So I'm curious about that because I had a similar experience. So do you have a thought on what should be done in order to educate people when they're younger on the options that are out there? I just am concerned that people's cultural and religious upbringing is just an expectation. It seems to just be an expectation and not a choice. Mm-hmm. And how to, just your thoughts on that and maybe how to get the options out there, you know, a little bit younger.
Yeah, well, I think two overt ways. One is certainly the education in the schools. When you have schools and you're taught about the history of our nation, well, we're taught a lot about the Methodists and the Baptists and, you know, the missionaries that come in and out and stuff, but we're never told about the Unitarians. Unitarians have been so viable and vital to this nation, and yet they're not talked about, and we don't talk about ourselves, and so there's this silence. So I think to ask for your schools and your teachers to be able to say, when you're speaking about history, or when you're, do you ever cover this, and you ever cover this, and you ever cover this. So I think there's an educational piece we need to do. But I also think that it has to do with when people come, well, I've educated my children's friends. When you have, or the Mormons that come and knock on my door, I invite them in.
Oh.
At the most you can do when you have a chance to speak to people, you tell them, you speak to them about other ways to think. And you go to these, you know, you have your friends who invite your daughter to go to the Lutheran church. And you say, well, honey, how was that? You know, after the sleepover or something. And then you talk about Unitarian Universalism. And you talk about ways to be in the world. And that there are so many different ways. Of course, I've grown up doing this because I'm also Jewish, living in a Christian culture. And so I've grown up really, I'm a Jew when I need to be a Jew. When there needs to be a Jew around, there I am. There needs to be a Norwegian in the group, there I am. A Russian, there I can be that too. So I definitely make myself known if there needs to be a little bit of an education point. But it's up to all of us to be out there speaking. I wish that as Unitarians we were more, I've been saying this for eons, but I said it today, I wish that we were more present in the community. Why aren't we doing the food pantries? Why aren't we doing the soup kitchens? Why aren't we the ones, you know, running the Goodwill or whatever. I mean, why aren't we the ones? Why is it not associated? The social services, why aren't they linked with Unitarian Universalists? Why is it linked with the Catholic Church predominantly? Why are we missing from that?
Some of us are in an ecumenical way doing that, but then we don't get any.
Exactly.
Mentioning.
Yes, we're involved as people. We are involved, but then the association isn't with the Unitarians. Oh, the Unitarians are the ones who are, oh, it's the Unitarians. Mm-hmm. We're not out there. We need to be out there more.
The Quakers are very known.
Yes, the Quakers are very known.
I'll go back to my suggestion again, is that the Ripon Society has T-shirts, and they all say Ripon Unitarian Universalist Society. And then when we do go out, people recognize us and they know who we are. And I think that was a really good. I met these people. I had no idea who they were, and I saw their T-shirts. It was a democratic thing, and so it's a good idea.
It's an education.
That is a good idea.
Sell them as a fundraiser. We can buy them from
one of the small things
from the UU world. Sell them as fundraisers.
We had a design. We did print them one summer.
Oh yeah.
Dave, didn't you want us to get tattoos too?
I did it one time. Yes, I did because I saw a girl. In Walmart, looking at Walmart that had a Unitary tattoo.
Oh,
and I said, "What is that tattoo?" Yeah. And she says, "It's Unitary."
Yeah. Wow.
In Walmart, all places.
Well, I think what you're saying is true because I think that it's not the individuals that are doing these things. Like when you have a Catholic person, whatever, you're not associating. We know about these. It's the institution. It's the big churches. They are doing it, and then the people who are part of those institutions are the members who are involved. So the Unitarians, the UUA, the Unitarians, all of our congregations need to just make ourselves more visible.
Absolutely.
So I think that's
if we could segue into humanism a little bit. What about the UU Humanist group? How strong is it, or what has happened to it over the years? I mean, I know they've had a struggle, and can you talk about that a little
bit? They have had a struggle. But what I'm hearing, and I've been really out of this, I specifically left the ministry. I needed a sabbatical, and I needed to earn an income. Because as a part-time minister, you don't earn very much money. And I had three little kids. So I worked in the district attorney's office for many years. I was a municipal court judge for a while. And then I lived in Sweden. So I've been sort of out of the Unitarian ministry for a while. But what I'm hearing and what I'm reading is that there seems to be a change now within the UUA, or coming about, or hopefully coming about, that there seems to be more of an understanding of what humanism can offer and has offered and is. And so there doesn't seem to be the same battle and pushing humanists to the side that there was when all the years that I was in seminary and beyond.
Now, this group is, we are affiliated with the American Humanist Association, which was started in part by a Unitarian, including, Sarah wasn't Sarah Obergenbarden, I think, involved in that. And it's my understanding, am I right, that they were kind of edged out by the Unitarians?
Well, there was a whole change in policy at the UUA about independent affiliate organizations, and sort of a wholesale disaffiliation because they felt there are too many of them, too.
So it was more than the humanists.
Oh, yeah.
It was other independent associations.
Yeah, the Unitarian Universalist Infidels, the Pagans, and the humanists. And it was made much harder for them to, more hoops for them to go through to be affiliated with the UUA. And this is something that Peter Morales was familiar with, and that mistakes were made, and he wants to correct this.
So humanism was removed from Unitarian groups?
The American Humanist Association was removed from its independent affiliate status.
But there's still, the UU Humanists are still affiliated, am I correct?
I think they were also.
Were they? You think they were?
Would surprise me, but they were sort of in-house humanists, and even they were disaffiliated.
So maybe we're going to get back in?
Maybe.
We'll see. I think you should be there.
Well, as with everything, I think it's an educational piece. I think if people understand the history of humanism within UUism, I think it would be a lot harder to dispute and to not have us be a viable entity. But again, it's just an educational piece. People don't really know. And humanists can be a little crabby, and they can sort of put themselves on the outside of things as well. And so there needs to be a little bit of a modification that way, too, I think.
Can you pursue that comment a little bit? Why humanism as an ethic has been pushed to the side in the UUA in general?
Well, my feeling about it, what was going on, is because of growth. The UUA wanted to grow. And because our nation misunderstands the word of what humanism means, it is associated so almost like with devil worship. Or with this incredible arrogance that you are so arrogant that you think just about yourself and that you don't, that's like my supervisor said to me, oh, so you think you're God, you know. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. These are such ridiculous statements. But the UUA, understanding that this is a Christian nation and wanting to grow and not taking the time or the, using the energy to educate about what humanism really is about and the dynamism of it, thought, well, if we really want to grow, let's just take language that we really do know, which is the spiritual language, and let's just focus on that in order to grow. And sort of buying into the cultural misunderstanding of what humanism really is all about. I mean, there is, at St. John's University, which is a Catholic college, there is a humanist department. It's the Catholic humanist department. And because they're using the word humanist to mean humanitarian and things that need to be done, which is fine. Now, they also are using God and Jesus, so that's a different thing than what we talk about when we're talking about humanism, but it's still the human being is still doing the humanitarian work. And so I think that there's a tendency with all these factions to just be so unto themselves instead of reaching their hands across and saying, here's what we have in common. Yes, you believe in God. Yes, you worship Mary, but you have this great department that's humanitarian. I would like to get involved with that, or what can I do as a humanist? You know what I'm saying? To reach our hand across and to find what we have in common with all of these different places instead of just maintaining unto ourselves, because we're too small. Humanists are too small, UUs are too small, and we're all too small, and we all have this world to fix.
It sounds like you're advocating a proactive approach. Be proud of the terms humanistic and ethical, rather than saying to couch the word God in other terms. Just use a whole different set. Be proud. It's an alternative people to look at.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And even with UUs, there's so much about what, when you ask a UU what you believe in, they will tell you a whole slew of things they don't believe. It's all a list of what we don't believe instead of what we do believe. And it's an educational piece. It's all of this is an educational piece. Providing the language. What is it that we believe? What is it that's important to us? What is it that we stand for? What is it that we are passionate about? What is it that we will never give up? What is it that is our core? And ask people to do this and to speak to these things. I did a service once at a UU congregation that, because there was so much crabbiness and so much injury and wounds from people's past, and they found Unitarianism, and they were just like, oh, those Christians, or oh, those Lutherans, oh, those Catholics, ah. And I thought, well, this is not healthy to have all this negative energy. And so I did a service asking everybody, whoever wanted to, and everybody did, to talk about what their past religious background was. Where did they come from? How were they raised? What was it that they wanted to get rid of? What didn't work for them? And then, what was it that was important that they wanted to retain? What was it that was very important to them that they felt that they didn't want to give up? So they ended saying these positive things.
We actually did that here one.
Really? And it's a really important thing, because you get to say, it's not all bad. There were some things that were bad, and I couldn't go with that, and so that's why I left it. But you know what? There were some good things, too. And then to get to know other people who have the same story. Because life is about learning other people's stories. When I lived in Sweden and worked with those, well, the Swedes, but worked with the immigrants, I didn't know anything about Iran or Iraq or Afghanistan. I know what our news media was telling us, but I didn't know up close and personal anything. And providing language allowed me to get to know these people. Everybody's, we're all just the same. We are all just the same. We all have our same struggles and our same hurts and pains and sorrows, and that life has let us down, or we have joys and concerns, but we just come at it differently, and we have different things that speak to us and different things that sustain us. And some of it's another person, some of it's God or whatever. But if we can just reach across and say, what is it that we have in common, and to be able to listen and to be asked to be heard, there's a lot that we can do to come together as a community and as a larger community and as a nation, I think.
Ron, I just wanted to say a couple things that might tie together a couple of threads I've been hearing here. One was about, you know, how can we learn more, how can we grow, and this question you just asked too. I think the people that have studied congregations and growth have said that the number one factor in why a congregation grows is because people invite their friends. That's how they grow. It has nothing to do with what they believe. It has nothing to do even with what denomination they are. It's because people enjoy being at that congregation and they invite their friends to come. Now, having said that, I think it gets back to what you had brought up before, and it's the question about how do we know more, and it relates directly to what you say about finding positive ways to say things. In ethical culture, we have this thing where people say, we need to develop an elevator speech. You know what an elevator speech is?
Yes.
When somebody asks you, what do you mean ethical culture? What the hell is it? And you're on an elevator and you've only got like 4 floors to answer before you get off. How do you answer them in that short of a time? And I think that when you quoted Corn before about, you know, thinking with the heart and feeling with the mind, for a generation, I would say, or more, of leaders in the humanist movement in the United States, certainly, if not the world, that was a very out-of-step voice. Because most leaders were thinking with the mind. And so when they are asked, what is humanism, and they can try to develop some positive statement about it, they don't have an elevator answer. They've got like a two-hour answer. And most people, they're not, when they ask you that question, they don't want the two-hour answer. They want the two-minute answer.
What is your elevator speech?
I'll give it to you later. That's a good idea, as Harry is now. I don't have a unitarian elevator speech.
Donna?
You know, I think that the Quakers put themselves on the map by some of the great deeds that they have done in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you want to develop this idea and do something good because you believe in humanism, one should find humanistic acts, or maybe an act, you know, to focus on something like food in some way, or homelessness, or whatever, and put yourself on the map all across the country with the humanists doing this act that everybody respects. And then they can come from there, be drawn from there.
Yeah, I agree. It's deeds, not creeds. I mean, just go and do it. Whatever you believe, do it. But it's easy. It's better. Each Unitarian or each humanist is already doing a lot themselves. But it's as a group that we seem to be missing some things. And so I think if there was a united effort somehow, that would be a really good thing, because it's very visible then.
Well, there's the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee that does, you know, it's like the Quaker, the Friends. Mm-hmm. So that's our service organization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd like to turn what Donna said around a little bit, because it seems to me that maybe instead of having something that you do that everyone knows you by, maybe you need to have something that you don't do that everyone knows you by. Mm-hmm. Because my acquaintanceship with the Quakers, despite all the wonderful works they do, which I learned about as I grew older, was the fact that they were pacifists, that they refused to fight, refused to go to war. And I think that's how everybody knew who the Quakers were. So maybe we should find something that we refused to.
Well, also the Unitarians in the 60s. Well, and in the 60s, too, many Unitarian congregations, well, they were very involved in the civil rights movements, but those churches were sanctuaries.
That's true. Yes.
They were the sanctuaries. Those doors were open to anybody who did not want to go off to war, they could go and to be. And so it was very, very well known that that's what the UU, or Universalists, or the Unitarians really stood for.
We weren't a sanctuary, but we did take part in a sanctuary.
Okay. Yeah.
Nicaragua. Oh, okay. I want to bring up the religious humanism movement. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, I don't know about the movement exactly, but I am a religious humanist simply because I live life in a religious manner, meaning that I really, my heart is very involved in wanting the world would be a better place, and caring about my neighbor, caring about what's going on in the world and wanting to get involved. And that's a religious act. It is a religious act to get involved in society and to do these works and to care and to have that compassion.
Well, there's a web page if you do a Google search, and there's a meeting every year on one of those islands off of Maine. It's not the same, it's not the Star Island, but it's another one. And as I looked at it a little over a year ago, at least, one of the prominent members was a Catholic priest. It's interesting. He actually is an employee of the Vatican, but he's an astronomer, professional astronomer, who's in charge of the Catholic Church's astronomy research project in Tucson, Arizona. They have their own telescope there on top of one of those.
And he's part of the religious humanists?
Yeah. So I'm curious about that. He's paid by the Vatican.
We need to contact him. Find out his
lives
story.
In Tucson. Well, there his official go. Address.
Wow. Yeah.
I worked in Peace Corps in Paraguay for a number of years, and as a side project there, I worked in a very nice little orphanage. It was just a house that some nuns set up for homeless girls. And they provided, I went over there every week to provide some Saturday programs for them. And everything I saw, I just thought was so loving and caring for those dozen or so girls. And yet the Catholic Church itself, I've seen so many things that maybe cancels out the good, and the fact that they won't allow birth control in places that sorely need it, not only for birth control, but for the prevention of the spreading of disease. So could some entities be doing a lot of good, but be canceled out by some of the things that aren't so good?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have always really liked the Catholic Church because of the good things that they do. But then there's that the political aspect. Those bad decisions are politically motivated. And it's to keep the numbers so that there will be more little Catholic people born into this Catholic Church. It's all very, very political. And it's a control effort. But it has, so much of it has very little to do with the people who are actually just people wanting to do good things.
Political views come from, I think, a deep human belief on their part. I mean, they really believe that. I don't think it's just political. I mean, they really believe.
Sure. Well, they believe in what the story is being told about it, but the motivation for those original practices are politically motivated. But people don't really know that. Well, a lot of things that we are a part of here are politically motivated things, and we just don't know that because of how it's being presented to us.
So where do we draw the line for respect for someone else's views?
As long as you can only respect what's good, and things that are harmful you can't respect, but you don't have to throw out all of it. You know, you can't just chuck everything. That is, I mean, I just think it's a dangerous thing to do. I think that there is good in things. Well, like somebody said here, you know, there are humanists who aren't good. Well, sure, people are people. There will certainly be that. But there are the essence of humanism is good. But then there's the actual individual. And that's the same with Catholicism. There's a lot of it that's good, a lot of it that isn't good. Focus on the things that are good. Those charities that exist and the things that are being done, like good. Good things.
I think you already said what I was going to say, because I was going to ask you, what do you mean by cancel out? You can't cancel out liberation theology just because there are pedophile priests and stuff. And basically, you already said that you have to take each separate item as one good or medium or bad entity and take it like that. I was just worried about this term, canceling out. What would you like to cancel out? How did you define that word, cancel out?
I'm not sure what I mean by that, except that it seems on the one hand they're doing good, but on the other hand they're doing harm.
Yeah.
And So can we just say in general, but I think you've already answered that, that the Catholic Church is, doesn't
do have both.
Because one cancels out the other. They do just as much harm as they do good.
But when you say cancel out, that means what are you throwing out then? The whole Catholic Church?
Yeah.
I think perhaps it's a contradiction. You have a priest who espouses liberation theology, yet he is a pedophile.
Yeah, well, most
that
of those
would create some stress. But look at the gentleman's philosophy. It's like a politician.
But
he has an affair.
That's an extreme case when you're choosing a liberation theologian in Latin America and a bunch of pedophiles in Milwaukee and Chicago.
I'm saying he's espousing, on one hand, is positive. Liberation theology, on the other hand, he's pedophile. So I would question his theology if, in fact, he's a pedophile. He does negative, unethical things, but yet, Sunday morning, he espouses liberation theology. I'm not saying it cancels out. I'm not saying it challenges the validity of what he's saying. It doesn't undercut.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I'm saying this is an extreme case. You picked an extreme example.
I think we're getting into a picky discussion over the word cancel.
Yeah.
And I understand Marcia's point in that, you've got this balance between what's good and what's pretty awful in some cases. I see it a lot in people that go to other countries and they're doing great medical things, and then on the other hand, they're teaching people dogma that I find very harmful. So, it tips the scale. That doesn't mean you get rid of it. And I think I have a sense of what she's trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's an example. What about these places that offer meals to homeless people or people in need, but on condition that they have to listen to the sermon?
That's paying dues.
That's awful hard for somebody who's hungry but doesn't want to hear the sermon.
I don't have a problem with that. If I get hungry, I have to work. I don't want to do that either. But I do it to get the sandwich. And so as long as they keep putting out the sandwiches and they don't spend taxpayers' money on it, it doesn't bother me that they have to do that. That's a small price to pay.
Are you guys looking for absolutes by any chance? Which is not possible. There are no, not even any ethical absolutes. They don't exist.
I wonder if I could change the subject just a little bit. You know, you're teaching in Sweden, or you were teaching, some of your students were from Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our book club here is now currently reading a book about that part of the world. And what's it called?
The Sewing Circle of Herat.
Herat, yeah. Oh, marvelous book by a British woman who's serving.
She's a journalist.
Yeah, she's sort of a traveling journalist. Marvelous. Anyhow, I wonder what you've learned from your students about
these places they left.
The people and the Islamic religion.
It was very interesting.
Apropos of what we're talking
about. Well, the first thing I learned was, because I was afraid to say, oh, guess what, I'm American. And they were thrilled. Oh, American. Oh, yay. How great that you're there. Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. And they, really? So that was a surprise to me. What I learned was that, because I was very ignorant about their culture, very, very, very ignorant. The men that I taught, the men and the women were taught separately. And they, historically, they are kept apart, so there that worked. The men were knew how to read and to write in their own languages, and so I was teaching them Swedish. So they would go to the library, they could look on the internet, and they can look in their own languages and read the newspaper and know what's going on. They would meet downtown, and they would have coffee, and they would talk, and they would keep up on things. And then I had people in my class that were from bus drivers to a general who had been in the army, a military person for all of his life, and he was 60-some years old. Okay, so what I learned, and the women none of them knew how to write, none of them knew how to read, none of them had ever been out into school at all. And so Sweden mandates for every immigrant that comes that you have to take 700 hours of language, because unless you know language, you are not going to be able to participate in society or get a job or even be able to go shopping. They're provided with housing, they're provided with their schooling, they're provided with the daycare, because this is, you know, just like the Swedes would be. I mean, it's the same. They were regarded as Swedish citizens. The group that I was teaching had done that 700 hours, and they still just couldn't get the language thing down. And now they had been in Sweden for 3 to 5 years and just were still speaking in their little groups and just functioning, being able to function, but had not learned Swedish.
Did they have a mindset against it, too,
they just
were a female?
Both the males and the females I was teaching, they just couldn't get it.
But coming from that other culture, did they have a mindset against learning for women?
No. But it was just such a foreign thing, and they didn't understand why they needed to. And also in Sweden, the women were, because they had to take these classes, they had to leave their homes. Mm-hmm. They had to go out into the community. And they were used to just being home. And so that was very stressful. Then it was stressful for the men to see these women out. So it was a whole lot of stress going on. And then once women learned the language and they learned their rights, there were a lot of divorces that happened in Sweden. Because they did not like the being told what to do. They didn't like the abuse. They couldn't be, because you can't even, there's zero tolerance in Sweden for physical abuse. Zero tolerance. And so if there's anything, you report it and then you're arrested. And that's the end of that. So the women learned all of this. And the children were learning this. The children picked up language really, really fast. And they would come home and they would educate their parents, or they would say, you need to call the police, or you need to do this, blah, blah, blah. So there was a lot of familial breaking down because of this whole thing.
My goodness. There's a book there.
Was this a specific people that came? How did they happen to all come from the areas, those areas?
In Sweden, they took in 44,000 immigrants, and so they are spread all over the country. And they, yes, and these particular people that I was with, until they get their citizenship, they are placed in communities. They have to stay in those communities. As soon as they are regarded as permanent citizens, then they can move anywhere they want to. But right now they have to go to communities, because the communities need to take responsibility for housing and all those kind of things. So they're distributed all throughout.
Here's a little humanist dilemma for you. Here you have a family that's functioning as a family. And how ethical is it to change this family in a rather sudden fashion, not by educating the children so that they might move? Mm-hmm. I'm asking this as a question, because we were Peace Corps volunteers in Afghanistan ourselves 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's an ethical dilemma. We have that same dilemma here in the United States. You know, we have groups from Somalia and, you know, the genital mutilation. Well, is this allowed? Do we allow this? Or is this part of a cultural tradition? I mean, we have these are really, really, really difficult questions. They are difficult questions.
However dysfunctional the family was by Swedish standards, it was a functioning family.
Right. And the Sweden, but Sweden wasn't telling them, you now need to break up your family. Sweden was saying, here, even though we understand this is how your family structure works, you are now in Sweden. And we as a country have this policy. There is zero tolerance for these kinds of things. But yeah, it's a challenge. Sweden is having a challenge.
But Mary, it was functioning in a particular Afghanistan way when the women were taught and learned that they had other options. They did have the guts to divorce. So they chose another kind of functioning. And I think that is really should have the priority, because half of the, you know, human race is female, and so how many of them still have to live under that old...
Well, one of the things that Sweden went through, which it didn't know it was going to go through, it had taken immigrants before, historically, from Finland and from Bosnia and stuff, but the difference between those immigrants and these new immigrants is the color of the skin and the religious background. Everything was very different. And the cultural background, the grouping of the groups and the homes. I mean, these homes were just filled with all of these families, extended family, because that's the structure. And so Sweden's okay with that, and everything was okay. But then when these groups in order to feel comfort and familiarity, would want to be more and more and more together. Then there was us versus them feeling, the Swedes were feeling they don't want to be a part of our culture, and these groups are saying, well, we don't even know your country and your culture, why can't we retain us? And so there was this. So what Sweden went through, and it's going through now, and it's a huge painful process for it, is discrimination and racism and prejudice. And here's Sweden, who really has prided itself for so long to not have these feelings and these thoughts, coming smack up against this. And it's a huge, huge thing that they're wrestling with.
So this is a humanist
question.
Yeah. It's a humanist dilemma. Yeah.
You keep saying immigrants. And I guess my question is, an immigrant is someone who, under their own volition, wants to leave their home and go to... Are these immigrants or refugees?
They're both. They're immigrants and refugees. Okay. And there were also, I worked also in an orphanage for, orphaned refugee children, and they were refugee children.
So it was a mix. A big difference.
Right, but it was a mix. Yeah. And so therefore those dynamics were also a mix of how they felt about being in Sweden.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was very complicated. It was extremely, I felt really amazingly honored to be a part of that, because I don't... live a life like that here, and it was really important work. Yeah.
Sweden has taken a lot more people from Iraq and all of those places than we have in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
We've created these refugees, and we haven't.
And then you don't take them
in. Yeah.
Just a comment. I have a Swedish friend that immigrated to the United States, and he said he left because in Sweden everything is illegal.
That's very funny.
Apparently, like you said, anybody can call the cops and they arrest people.
Yeah,
everything's only tender.
How long ago was that?
A couple years ago.
Oh, just recently.
That's very.
He came over here and made a fortune.
It is very hard. Well, it's very hard to be an entrepreneur in Sweden. It's very hard. It's very difficult to do. You can't just hang out a shingle. I couldn't just advertise, come to me and I'll teach you English. I couldn't do that.
Yeah. What you have to do in order to do that?
It's very complicated. It's just a huge, complicated process.
Lots of government papers.
Lots of governmental stuff, and you have to have this and this. I mean, it was just... Because they tax everything. Mm-hmm. And so you can't be setting out a shingle, because how could they know that you exist and that you're getting money, and where's that money going, and how can they tax you?
Can't have a lemonade stand.
Because you can't have a tax. You have to be taxed, because then you get all this stuff for your taxation. So that's sort of the negative side, though. I didn't think any of it was negative. I was like, tax me up the kazoo and give me this life, please.
Well, so do they have the kind of financial mess that we have now?
Yes, they do.
They do?
Yes.
To the degree, too, as badly?
I don't know, but they're really feeling it.
They're feeling
it. Yeah.
But in general, it's a little less harsh in Europe than it is.
Well, yes, exactly.
Because the crooks are more crooks here.
Well, it's easier to still function in those countries. Yeah. In our country, it's hard to function anyway if you don't have, because we have haves and have-nots here.
There's no safety net.
There's no safety net. There, there's a safety net. Yeah. So,
And you have the big crooks in power. Yeah. More so than in Europe.
What's your next career move?
Well, hopefully within a matter of moments or at least days, I will hear whether I'm being asked to be the consulting minister for the Heartland UU congregation, which is halfway to Milwaukee.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And not that far. So, no.
I've tried to find the city center in Heartland a couple of times. I know somebody who lives there.
Oh, yeah.
The country. Couldn't find any.
Yeah.
So, where is it?
Yeah, so we drive around. I was like, where is this? Sort of meanders around.
Obviously, where the UU church is.
Right, that will become the center. Yes. Thank you for that. What? There we go. I'll bring the plaque with me. I'll have it tucked into my arm. Yeah.
So you're moving back to Wisconsin?
I live here in Madison.
You live here now?
I live on the nearest side.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that that happens, because, oh my gosh.
So would you commute to Harvard?
I will commute. And what their goal is within the next 3 years is to have a full-time minister. So when they did this four-hour interview, which had just happened, they asked me, they said, now, do you... because you've been a part-time minister all these years, you know, is that your preference? And would you maybe not want to be a full-time minister? I'm like, oh my God. I would love to be a full-time minister. And I said, you know, there is no such thing as a part-time minister. Yeah. There is no such thing.
Yeah.
There's part-time pay. So yes, I would love the opportunity to be full-time. And in which case, if I were so lucky to get this job, I would commute. And then if I would be able to be there full-time, then I would definitely move to be there. Because I also think you can't be as effective if you don't live in the community.
Yeah.
Even being part-time, I've already tried to figure, and we talked about this, like how could I still be involved and be in effective and not just be the Sunday speaker? Mm-hmm. Because that's then not being a minister, that's just the Sunday speaker. Yeah. And so how to do that. So we really discussed that, but that's what I hope.
Would you want to be your congregation to be known as a humanist congregation?
I don't care about that. I think it would be a humanist congregation with the openness to understanding that there are all so many ways for an individual to get their sustenance when times are hard. But my language will never be anything other than what it is. So it would, by dint of that, if I were the minister, it would be that. But I think starting out to just be a UU congregation would be enough for that little community. You don't need to also add the humanist part to it. That can take some time to just let the human people, part of the UU group, be out there and present and speak about it themselves.
What's their membership?
2 years ago, they were 50 adults and some kids. And then they bought a building, and now there are 130 adults and 120 children.
Oh, wow.
They have a very, very prominent church building, and they have 5 acres of land, and it's very visible. And that building, that is definitely build it and they will come. They moved in, and it's just, and it's lots of young families and children just up the, as many children as adults, basically. It's
amazing. Well,
I've been reading some economics and about capitalism, and Adam Smith, who said there's an invisible hand of capitalism which makes it all work, and you can't really see it, but it works. And I think there's an invisible hand of potlucks here. you don't say, and you look at it, it's always somehow the invisible hand makes it.
Yeah.
You have some desserts, and I think that may also be true, say, of prairie, and maybe of your new thing. But somehow, it all works together, and I think if I had my complete way of prayer, it probably would collapse. And likewise the spiritual people. But I think if somehow that mix comes together without anybody knowing how.
Yeah.
And I think we ought to be careful not to break it, because we maybe couldn't put it back together.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's to be open to and somehow respectful of, but not to have the factions. Really try to not have the factions. This is how we believe, and this is how we believe, and we don't like this, and we don't like this. I mean, try not to do that.
No crabbiness.
Try not to be crabby. Really, really try not to be crabby. Yeah. And leave your dictionaries at home.
I'm very disappointed in the policy that you have. This has nothing to do with humanism versus more traditional religion, but the policy of benefiting the huge churches as opposed to the small ones.
Yeah.
I think that's terrible.
It's self-defeating, I think.
It isn't. It's
Let your voice be heard. Write to Peter Morales, let your voice be heard.
Yeah. Even in cities, we have small towns.
Yeah, well, you can talk about it here until your head rolls off all across the floor. But I think if you want to make change, you need to talk to the people who can
make
that change.
Contribute to them every year. We might make our contributions more contingent.
Yeah.
Ooh, I don't know. The invisible hand.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, thank you very much,
Jane.
Well,
thank you.
And good luck.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes.